He was younger. If you keep learning all the time, you have a wonderful advantage. Back then, however, Buffett was utterly wasted on me. Still, as the saying goes, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. Sure enough, Warren Buffett reappeared in my life 4 years later when I stumbled upon his introduction to The Intelligent Investor and then read about him in Lowenstein's biography. By then, I was going through hell at D.H. Blair. My arrogance had taken such a beating that I was open to Warren's teachings in a way that I never would have been as an MBA student. I had been so humbled and humiliated by my experience at D.H. Blair that it forced me to re-examine everything I believed. Such are the sweet uses of adversity. There is, of course, a certain irony here. Joining D.H. Blair was the worst decision of my life, but it was also a gift, not only because this humiliation opened my mind, but also because my experience there taught me lessons I could never have learned in the classrooms and quadrangles of the finest universities. In fact, D.H. Blair may paradoxically have been the perfect place for me to start my career, because it showed me, in a raw and unvarnished form, everything that was wrong with Wall Street. I saw up close the willingness to distort the truth in order to further one's own narrow self-interest, the tendency to treat clients as marks to be exploited, not served. At their worst, elite investment banks like Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan are not all that different, but the shafting of clients happens with a much greater veneer of respectability. When I began to understand the principles that Warren Buffett embodied, I realized that there was another way to succeed. This discovery changed my life. Chapter 3. The Firewalk. My first steps as a value investor. After leaving D.H. Blair, I had the hardest time finding another job. There was this stain, a damned spot on my hitherto pristine resume that I couldn't wash out. I had mistakenly given D.H. Blair the benefit of the doubt, but prospective employers were, understandably, not willing to give me that same benefit. My resume was strong enough that I could land interviews with companies like Goldman Sachs, Sanford Bernstein, and Credit Suisse First Boston, but I was damaged goods, and none of them would hire me. Wall Street insiders who understood D.H. Blair's reputation looked at me like this. Either I'd been too stupid to figure out what was going on, or I was a dangerous fellow who was willing to push the boundaries of what was prudent. Either way, they wouldn't touch me. I felt a growing sense of despondency as the rejections piled up. In the deepest emotional recesses of my brain, words like rejection and can't find a job were closely connected to words like failure and leprosy. I really did start to feel like a leper. Then there was my inner critic, the voice inside my head that said, "What's the point in doing this? It's not going to get you anywhere." Or the more toxic version of this negative self-talk. "There you go again, you moron. You're always failing. You'll never have a successful career in finance." But before long, I would find a way to get unstuck and begin rewiring myself. The details of how this happened are specific to me, but the process relates to anybody who has been stuck and needs desperately to find a way forward. In a sense, what I really needed to do was re-educate myself, or for that matter, uneducate myself. This process began in the most unexpected way with my discovery of the self-help guru Tony Robbins. His name had come up in a conversation with a very smart Swiss couple who had PhDs from Stanford. I prided myself on being a serious thinker with a powerful grasp of economics and finance. My intellectual snobbery made it easy to dismiss someone like Robbins. With all my education, how could I possibly learn anything valuable from this crass American? I don't think I would have been willing to find out more about Robbins if these friends had not been Europeans with stellar academic pedigrees. I hate to admit this because it exposes the shallow intellectual values that I had at the time. For me, the beginning of wisdom was to drop these narrow prejudices so that I could begin to learn from everyone. I had been planning to spend the weekend hanging out and relaxing in San Francisco, but one of my Swiss friends, Diana Weiss, told me that Robbins was doing a seminar there and that it would change my life. The title of the event was Unleash the Power Within. I was full of misplaced skepticism, but I was able to get out of my own way sufficiently that I showed up. In retrospect, I come to see that this is a smart strategy for life. Whenever I have the choice of doing something with an uncertain but potentially high upside, I try to do it. The payoffs may be infrequent, but sometimes they're huge, and the more often I pick up these lottery tickets, the more likely I am to hit the jackpot. This is an application of a powerful philosophy that Monish describes in his book, The Dando Investor, The Low-Risk Value Method to High Returns. As he puts it, heads I win, tails I don't lose much. Looking around the convention center on the outskirts of San Francisco, I wondered what the hell I was doing there. This looked like some kind of cult, with about 2,000 people in the audience. What sort of self-promoting quack was this guy Robbins, and what sort of motley loser crowd had he gathered around him? Robbins himself struck me as a rugged, quintessential Californian. He was almost 7 feet tall, and his energetic delivery was infectious. Many people in the audience were jumping up and down, yelling out things like, "Yes, yes, yes, I am a force for good," and "Step up, step up, step up." This set off alarm bells in my head. Was Robbins just some poor player strutting and fretting his hour upon the stage? Was he just an idiot telling his story, full of sound and fury but signifying nothing? I stood at the back, barely participating, but over several hours, in spite of myself, I found that I was opening up to the possibility that he had something to teach me. Robbins won me over in part by being transparent about his motives. At one point he told us, "Look, I'm an American just like you. My motivation is to be happy and successful and to live the best life I can, and like most of you, I also want to make money and be rich, richer than I am today. A big part of how I do that is by running seminars like this, but as much as I want to get richer, even more than that, I like helping people, and I know that I can teach you things that will help you and that are worth much more than the entry fee." It was a great example of the power of authenticity, of speaking honestly and from the heart. His candid admission of his own self-interest convinced me to give him the benefit of the doubt, so I stayed. In some ways, my original misgivings were right. Robbins' seminars are a form of brainwashing. Shouting things out often enough really does pound it in, and any idea can be implanted by repeating it over and over. There's a danger to this, one that can be exploited by religious fundamentalists and political extremists, but in this case, it was brainwashing for the good, designed to help us live a better, more successful life. I'm all for that sort of brainwashing. Our consciousness changes our reality, and I began to see that the positive statements Robbins got us to repeat were a powerful tool in reconfiguring my consciousness. Since then, I've often found that we have to imagine our future before it happens. The power of human consciousness was illustrated in an unforgettable way that first night of the seminar. Robbins had whipped us into a mood of intense joy combined with extreme determination. In this altered state, we stepped onto a lawn outside the convention center, removed our shoes and socks, and literally walked on red-hot embers. I don't know what the rational or scientific explanation is for why our feet didn't burn, but for many of us, this was a transformative experience. I could see the difference in people's eyes afterwards, as if a new fire and passion had been ignited in them, and in me. Hokey as it might seem, this 20-foot firewalk created a metaphor for how I could break through my limitations and build a better reality. It was an experiential lesson that allowed me to understand how, as Robbins puts it, life can change in a heartbeat. A goal that seems impossible in one instant can become entirely possible in the next if only you are willing to devote every ounce of your mind, body, and soul to reach it. My empirically minded Oxford professors, who had done so much to train me in the ways of logical thought, would have been amused and bemused at the impact on me of this motivational speaker, but his message was exactly what I needed to hear at a time when my formal education had led me to a professional dead end. For example, Robbins hammered into my head the idea that if you want to get somewhere, anywhere, and you're stuck, just do it. Just make a move, any move. This might be obvious to many. Hell, it was obvious to me. But my bias toward analysis paralysis meant that it was easier for me to pontificate in a library than to act. Robbins convinced me that I had to break the patterns of negative thought, push through my fears, and get moving. As Theodore Roosevelt told an audience in Paris in 1910, it is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood. Having opened up to Robbins, I started voraciously reading books by other self-help gurus. Before attending his seminar, I would have rolled my eyes at a book entitled How to Win Friends and Influence People, but Warren Buffett himself credits the author Dale Carnegie with having helped him enormously. In fact, Buffett has said that the only diploma he keeps in his office is a certificate confirming that he had successfully completed the Dale Carnegie course in effective speaking, leadership training, and the art of winning friends and influencing people. I would have been equally dismissive of Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill, even though it had won over Prem Watsa, the highly successful chairman and CEO of Fairfax Financial Holdings, who is frequently described as the Canadian Warren Buffett. For a while, these books became my life instruction manuals. I wasn't reading them to sound intelligent at dinner parties. I was mining them for useful ideas to implement in my life. They provided me with critical first steps in my education as a value investor and businessman, exposing me to a more practical way of thinking about human nature and how the world really works. For example, Carnegie explains that the best way of convincing someone of something is to appeal to their self-interest. Likewise, he talks about the power of using people's names when you address them, and the importance of showing genuine interest in the person. These simple insights helped me to shift the way I interacted with people. Previously, I would have focused on deploying my intellect to show them how smart I was or to appeal to the rational mind. I was too clever by half. I started using the lessons of the self-help genre in a conscious way, seeking to brainwash myself into new habits of success. I even changed the way I talked to myself and others. Instead of saying, "I feel sick," I'd say, "I'm looking forward to feeling better." Trite as this may sound, having a positive attitude is crucial because our minds have a way of moving toward what we focus on. Schools and universities are so dedicated to developing the intellect that we can easily end up ignoring these simple strategies that make for a happier and more productive life. At around the same time that I was learning these ideas, I was also taking practical steps to get me out of my rut. I joined the New York Society of Securities Analysts and started attending their lunchtime sessions in the World Trade Center. I'd rush across Zuccotti Park to get there, no longer having the time to dawdle with the chess players. I also bought some software from the American Association of Individual Investors to screen for Ben Graham-style net-net stocks. I put together mock portfolios in Excel spreadsheets and updated the prices by hand each week. I felt a rush of excitement as I saw that many of the portfolios I had assembled did much better than the market as a whole. I also invested in a subscription to Value Line and pored over the new issues. It was in these pages that I noticed a company called the Burlington Coat Factory, which seemed cheap and had a long-term financial record that impressed me. It was the first stock I ever bought. I was captivated by Graham's insight that a stock isn't just a scrap of paper to trade, but a part ownership in a business. So I visited the company's stores in New York and Omaha with relish and excitement, feeling like a true capitalist whose money was at work in a real business. I knew almost nothing at the time, but I held on to the stock for a couple of years and made a small profit. Meanwhile, I started to see that there was a small ecosystem of value investors out there who operated with the same sort of intellectual and moral integrity that characterized Buffett. They were the antithesis of some of the people I'd encountered at D.H. Blair, the eschewed hype, focusing instead on serving the long-term interests of their shareholders. I felt a burning desire to be a part of their world. One company in particular stood out in my mind as a bastion of this type of investing, Tweedy Browne, which had been founded in 1920. I dreamed of getting a job at a place like this, so I bought some shares in two of the company's mutual funds, then asked if I could come by to see the firm's offices in Manhattan. I had hoped they would hire me, but they weren't looking for an analyst. at least not one like me. Still, I felt the thrill of walking on this hallowed ground. I knew that Buffett's old friend Walter Schloss had worked out of an office here for decades and had racked up extraordinary returns. Once again, I felt the sting of rejection, but they were kind enough to give me a copy of Buffett's classic essay, The Superinvestors of Graham and Doddsville. I brought it home and discovered in it the spectacular investment record of another leading value firm, Ruane Cunniff, which manages the Sequoia Fund. This was one of only two companies that Warren recommended to his clients after he closed his investment business in 1969 and returned his shareholders' money. Since its inception in 1970, the Sequoia Fund has risen by 38,819% versus 8,916% for the S&P 500 index. Hoping to find a job there, I wrote a letter to Ruane Cunniff and was invited to their offices by Carly Cunniff, a director who was also the daughter of one of the company's partners. I was in awe of her. She had grown up in a world where Graham, Buffett, and intelligent investing would have been regular topics of conversation over the family dinner table, and she had become an exceptional analyst. Carly, who passed away in 2005, was generous and gracious. Even though there was clearly no opening for me to work there and nothing I could do to help her, she took me around and introduced me to her colleagues. In doing so, she showed genuine care for me, and I was really touched. She also taught me a valuable life lesson. It's so important to show kindness and to be helpful to people early in their careers, even when they have done nothing to deserve it. She saw another human soul, gave me the benefit of the doubt, and did what she could to help a fellow value investor. One way to stay in this orbit was to buy shares in the Sequoia Fund. That would enable me to attend its annual meetings each spring at the New York Athletic Club, but the fund had been closed to new investors for many years, so I found someone on eBay who was willing to sell me a single share for $500, even though the net asset value was only $128. I then added to my position. I expect to keep these shares for the rest of my life. For me, the goal isn't to make money, though I'm guessing Sequoia will continue to outperform. It's really a question of choosing to have certain people in your life, however tangentially, who embody the values you admire. As we will discuss in detail later, creating the right environment or network helps to tilt the playing field subtly in the right direction so that you can become far more likely to succeed. Advantages are often created imperceptible step by imperceptible step, so it makes a difference to enter the universe of a firm like Ruane Cunniff. Many of the Sequoia attendees were also Berkshire Hathaway shareholders, and sometimes even the Berkshire managers attended. As a result, I met Lou Simpson, whom Buffett had handpicked to invest Geico's money in stocks and whom he once described as the best I know. Another cornerstone of my re-education involved studying Buffett's investment strategy with even greater intensity. There's no better way to do this than to read Berkshire Hathaway's annual reports. In those pre-internet days, that meant calling up the company and giving them my address over the phone. A few days later, my first copy of a Berkshire report addressed by hand arrived. It was a revelation. At D.H. Blair, I'd reviewed so many business plans with hockey stick charts and predictions that only went up. Berkshire's report came with a plain cover, and its highlight was a candid, non-promotional, easily understandable letter by Buffett. The report also featured a table showing the annual increases of the company's book value. It was pure information, not an attempt to lie with statistics or to sugarcoat the truth with pretty pictures printed on glossy paper. I'd never seen a report like this. It was designed to attract shareholders who were genuinely reading it for the right reasons. I'd assumed that the business world was all about shouting louder than the next guy so you could get attention, but Buffett was reaching out to people who weren't impressed by noise. As I read and reread a compilation of Berkshire's old annual reports, I began increasingly to think as Warren Buffett would. I know this sounds odd, but I felt that he was smiling on me whenever I behaved in a way that he might have behaved, and I felt as if he had turned away from me whenever I strayed from that path. This wasn't a matter of idol worship. It was about choosing a teacher who had already discovered the truths that I needed to learn. There is a wisdom here that goes far beyond the narrow world of investing. What I'm about to tell you may be the single most important secret I've discovered in all my decades of studying and stumbling. If you truly apply this lesson, I'm certain that you will have a much better life, even if you ignore everything else I write. What I stumbled upon was this. Desperate to figure out how to lead a life that was more like his, I began constantly to ask myself one simple question. What would Warren Buffett do if he were in my shoes? I didn't ask this question idly while sitting in a coffee shop sipping a cappuccino. No, I sat down at my desk and actively imagined that I was Buffett. I imagined what the first thing would be that he would do if he were in my shoes sitting at my desk. Robbins describes this process as modeling our heroes. The key is to be as precise as possible, picturing them in as much detail as we can. A related technique that he teaches is called matching and mirroring, which might involve changing the way you move or even breathe to match the other person's movement or breathing. In my experience, you start to feel what they feel, and you even start to think like them. This might sound peculiar, but the ability to mimic is one of the most powerful ways in which humans advance. Just think about how children learn from their parents. Given that this is a natural human instinct, it's important to be careful about whom we choose to model. The truth is, they don't even have to be alive. As Charlie Munger has explained, it also works if you go through life making friends with the eminent dead who had the right ideas. Luckily for me, this isn't a scientific book, so I don't have to prove or explain any underlying science, if there is any. But I can tell you authoritatively that on a subjective level, this has worked for me. The minute I started mirroring Buffett, my life changed. It was as if I had tuned into a different frequency. My behavior shifted, and I was no longer stuck. So how can you apply these insights? We all know that mentoring is a big deal. Students and young professionals are often told to seek out mentors, just as those of us who are further along are supposed to find people to mentor. That's all well and good if your heroes are accessible. Mine wasn't. Buffett wasn't sitting in his office in Omaha waiting for a call from this tainted graduate of D.H. Blair. Thankfully, this didn't matter. I could get many, if not all, of the benefits of having him as a mentor by studying him relentlessly and then imagining what he would have done in my shoes. Imagining that I was Buffett, I also began to study the companies in his portfolio, wanting to see them through his eyes and to understand why he owned them. So I ordered up the annual reports for his major holdings, including Coca-Cola, Capital Cities ABC, American Express, and Gillette. This again gave me that uncanny feeling that Warren, and perhaps God himself, was smiling at me. Then the annual reports started to arrive. I vividly remember reading the report for Capital Cities ABC. Until then, I had never looked closely at the accounts of such a successful media company. When I saw the cash flow statement, I found it hard to believe my eyes. The company was swimming in cash, and the income statement didn't come close to conveying the might of this cash-generating machine. Most of the companies I'd analyzed as an investment banker were either hemorrhaging cash or grossly overstating their cash-generating ability. It felt as if I were embarking on a second MBA. I then decided to attend Berkshire Hathaway's annual meeting. Through a friend of a friend who was already a shareholder, I got hold of a ticket and flew out to Omaha, not knowing a soul who would be there. I felt a rush of excitement on seeing Kiewit Plaza, the building where Buffett works, where the magic happens. I rented a car and drove past his pleasant but nondescript house with that same giddy sense of childlike joy. I also dined at his favorite restaurant, Gorat Steakhouse, sitting with a group of Berkshire shareholders who were also in Omaha for the first time. In investing terms, I had emerged from the desert, crossed the Red Sea, and found my promised land. There were two particularly memorable meetings for me in Omaha that year. One of them was Rose Blumkin, a Russian-Jewish immigrant who had founded the Nebraska Furniture Mart in 1937, using $500 that she'd borrowed from her brother. She transformed it into America's largest home furnishings company, and Berkshire bought a 90% stake in 1983 for $55 million based on a handshake without even auditing her books. Buffett later declared, put her up against the top graduates of the top business schools or chief executives of the Fortune 500, and assuming an even start with the same resources, she'd run rings around them. When I met Mrs. B, as she was known, she was 101 years old, but she was still an unstoppable force. She was a tiny lady driving a cart, surrounded by admiring fans who clearly bored her. When I got the chance, I looked her in the eye and asked impertinently, "So, Warren tells me you sell carpets. Can you make me a good price?" Her eyes lit up. "Aha," she replied. "Are you a real customer, or do you just want to make small talk like all these other people?" In that instant, I could see why Warren revered her. She was all business all the time, and she was completely transparent. She had briefly tried to retire at 95, but had soon gone back to work. Her motto was, sell cheap, tell the truth, and don't cheat nobody. Just as I wanted Warren Buffett in my life, this is the sort of person he wanted in his life. Over decades, he had created this environment. I was just beginning to create mine, and I was learning to discern the type of people I should have in it. The other encounter was with the Oracle himself, shortly before the annual meeting began. I was on my way into the toilets, and who was coming out but Warren? He smiled at me and said, "I always get a little nervous before these things." And then he walked on. When I had last seen Buffett in person, back when I was a student at Harvard, I couldn't be bothered to listen to him at all. Now I was excited to see him coming out of the men's room. Given his success, I had half expected him to be a distant figure. It hadn't occurred to me that he'd be so personable and down-to-earth to a total stranger. Even from this brief encounter, I could see the goodwill he harbored toward his shareholders. Throughout the meeting, I could also see that he had no pretenses, no airs and graces. He is who he is. Inspired by Robbins and Buffett, I had a growing sense of opportunity. Instead of feeling that every door was closed, I started to realize that it was possible to move forward. I was so obsessed with value investing that I hoped somebody would hire me as a stock analyst, but I still couldn't get a job. Then, out of nowhere, my father called from his home in London to suggest that I manage some money for him. It was 1996. At the time, he was probably the only person who would have trusted me, given my D.H. Blair blemish. Born in Israel to German refugee parents, my father, Simon Speer, had founded a small but successful company, Aquamarine Chemicals, which trades and distributes products to protect crops. He had seen my mounting fascination with investing, and he told me, "Guy, if you don't break out on your own now, you'd be completely nuts." That push got me started. He entrusted me with about $1 million. Within a year or so, he invested more, and two of his business associates invested alongside him. As a result, the fund's initial assets amounted to around $15 million. I named it the Aquamarine Fund, feeling that I was somehow rejoining the family business. The fund started trading on September the 15th, 1997. For the longest time I wanted to hide or at least obfuscate this aspect of my journey, I desperately wanted to prove to the world that my achievements were entirely my own, and it seemed like an unfair advantage to get started with my father's help. But I was grateful for this opportunity and daunted by the responsibility. In a couple of years, I went from being a Buffett wannabe to managing the overwhelming bulk of my father's life savings, along with assets from a small circle of friends and relatives. Even with this backing, my odds of success were small. The vast majority of hedge funds don't survive beyond 18 months, and it's tough to make it without enough assets to achieve scale. To cut costs, I ran the fund out of my apartment in New York. It was a pretty modest beginning, but I felt that I was finally doing what I had been born to do. Still, now the real test would begin. Would I succeed in turning all this theory into the elusive goal of long-term market-beating returns? Chapter 4. The New York Vortex. So I started running money for friends and family. I was 30 years old and relatively inexperienced, but there were a few things that I got right. In part, this involved figuring out what to avoid. Warren Buffett, quoting Henry Ford, often talks about the importance of keeping all your eggs in one basket, then watching that basket very carefully. One thing that appalled me, and that I'd seen too many times, was the Wall Street practice of having many eggs in many baskets. Even the most reputable mutual fund companies have a practice of selling multiple funds. The ones that do well are those that then get the marketing dollars and raise more money from investors. The ones that do poorly are either shut down or merged into the better performing funds. In the process, the failures are buried as if they'd never existed, while the successes are highlighted. I'd seen a similar thing happen at D.H. Blair. There, the brokers would put different clients into different stocks. The clients whose accounts went down would be a lost cause, but those whose accounts went up were good for more business. Similarly, the publishers of some investment newsletters have a practice of segmenting their mailing lists and sending different predictions under different titles to different people. They can then make hay with those segments of their overall mailing lists that have done well. These ruses disgusted me then, and they do now. I was determined that I would go through my entire investing career running only one fund, so that I would have just one track record, period. If the long-term performance of that fund is lousy, this will be obvious to everyone. There's no place for me to hide. Equally important, my family's money would also be in that one fund alongside my investors' money. Indeed, I've invested almost 100% of my net worth in the Aquamarine Fund. As a result, I'm truly eating my own cooking. This alignment of my own interests and my shareholders' interests is inestimably important. This isn't a sales pitch, it's simply a matter of pointing out that this approach is conducive to good investing, not least because it enables me to focus on that one portfolio instead of having scattered interests. In this, I consciously modeled Buffett, who has focused all of his investing energy on Berkshire Hathaway for decades. But there were other ways in which I deviated from the hard-won principles that he had taught me. For example, I should simply have copied the fee structure of his pre-Berkshire investment partnerships. He charged no annual management fee, but took a quarter of the profits above a 6% hurdle. This is an extremely unusual structure, but it's the best alignment I've ever seen between an investor and his shareholders. It truly embodies the principle of making money with them, not off them. Unless they do well, the fund manager earns nothing. However, in starting the Aquamarine Fund, I opted instead for the standard New York hedge fund fee structure. This meant that I'd receive a 1% annual management fee, which would reward me however poorly I performed for shareholders, plus an incentive fee of 20% of the profits. Why did I do this? In getting the fund going, I was inevitably surrounded by lawyers, brokers, and other advisors who all wanted to tell me how this game works. To them, the idea that I would adopt Buffett's unorthodox 1950s fee structure seemed outlandish. They wanted to protect me, explaining that I needed that steady income. They couldn't conceive of someone living off incentive fees that are entirely unpredictable. What they didn't see was that the 1-in-20 fee structure subtly misaligned my interests and my shareholders' interests. I allowed myself to be swayed by them, but I should have been more pig-headed in this case. I also wanted to copy Buffett by allowing investors to redeem their money only once a year. This helps the fund manager to invest for the long term, which benefits his shareholders. It also helps them psychologically because they think less often about how the fund is doing and whether to sell. After all, inaction and patience are almost always the wisest options for investors in the stock market. For the same reason, I find it better not to check the performance of my stocks every day, or for that matter every week, since this makes it harder to keep a long-term focus. In any case, my advisors thought this redemption policy was absurd. They insisted that I allow investors to redeem with just 30 days' notice. The trouble is, this means that the fund manager is always worrying about when shareholders can yank out their money. Later, when the market crashed in 2008, this structural flaw would prove to be a major vulnerability. Failing to stand my ground, I capitulated and accepted that these were well-established practices in New York hedge fund circles. The whole institutional environment made it hard for me to resist. In spite of my good intentions, I fell into a common trap. It's always easier to be with the crowd than to go against it. It gave me false comfort to know that this was the industry standard, even though I'd missed the opportunity to create the ideal structure. It was only later, when I met Monish Pabrai and again when the financial crisis hit, that I saw how much better it would have been to clone Buffett's partnership structure as precisely as possible. These misguided compromises weren't deadly sins, but when I look back on my investing career, it's painful to see how quickly I had allowed myself to drift away from the time-tested wisdom I had gained from Omaha. I could have gotten it totally right, a perfect score. I still had a solid passing grade, but these tiny differences matter in investing, a pursuit where small structural changes can add up to big differences in returns over time. Long-term compounding is an investor's best friend, so why get in its way? There's a huge benefit to getting these seemingly minor details right from the very start. Part of the problem was that it was so easy to get sucked into the vortex of the New York financial world with its skewed values and seductions. I felt that my mind was in Omaha, and I believed that I could use the force of my intellect to rise above my environment. But I was wrong. As I gradually discovered, our environment is much stronger than our intellect. Remarkably few investors, either amateur or professional, truly understand this critical point. Great investors like Warren Buffett, who left New York and returned to Omaha, and Sir John Templeton, who settled in the Bahamas, clearly grasped this idea, which took me much longer to learn. At the time, I thought about moving to Omaha myself, but had too many connections in New York that made me want to stay. Still, in those first years after getting started, I mostly kept aloof from the New York scene and from Wall Street. I worked in blissful isolation out of my one-bedroom apartment on West 66th Street, and then in a series of three informal office spaces. One of these was an apartment on West 58th Street, where Monica Lewinsky was a neighbor. Another was a two-bedroom apartment on West 55th, where David Neeleman, the founder of JetBlue, was my neighbor. I'd read that he, like me, had attention deficit disorder, ADD, yet he'd managed to build a successful company. I found this reassuring. Having him in the building was a frequent reminder that I could also overcome my idiosyncratic wiring. As investors, we all have shortcomings. As I came to see it, the key is to accept who we are, understand our differences and limitations, and figure out the ways to work around them. In the meantime, even without a professional-looking office, life was good. The fund was still tiny, but my investment returns were decent. The performance was driven by the success of stocks like Duff and Phelps credit rating, which rose sevenfold. It illustrated perfectly what I had learned from Buffett. Find companies that are cheap, that have an expanding moat around them, and that are awash in cash. While others got caught up in the tech bubble of the late 1990s, I didn't get lured in at all. Partly because I was in the orbit of cool-headed investors like Buffett, Ruane Cunniff, and Tweedy Brown. Their common sense helped to protect me from tech fever. This proved once again that environment trumps intellect. After 5 years, my fund had significantly outperformed the market. A slow but steady trickle of outside investors entrusted their savings to me. Eventually, Aquamarine's assets under management edged over $50 million, and I started to get noticed. I wasn't interested in Wall Street, but Wall Street was interested in me, and this was, at best, a mixed blessing. I was now on the radar of all sorts of people who wanted a piece of me. Some hoped I would hire them as a lawyer or an analyst. Some wanted to sell me a high-priced investment research service. Some wanted to be my broker. Some wanted me to pay them to market the fund in order to attract more assets. These people hoped that I might be the next Chris Hon or Bill Ackman, who were rapidly gaining recognition as two of the brightest investment stars of my generation. And these people were betting that there was money to be made if I lived up to their expectations, or wishful thinking. After all, I'd attended Harvard Business School with Chris and Bill, so there was a sense that I might be cut from the same cloth. I was dangerously flattered. Worse, all this attention had the effect of stimulating some macho desires in me. Competitive juices and testosterone that I hadn't felt in myself since my early days as an investment banker. After all, if all these marketing mavens, ambitious analysts, lawyers, and brokers were comparing me to Bill and Chris, why shouldn't I make the same comparison? I still remember one of them telling me that I should be running $5 billion, not $50 million. At some level, it was as if my very manhood was in question. At the time, Bill and Chris were going from strength to strength. Based on their stellar returns, they were running billions, while I was still a minnow. Before long, I felt a deep, avaricious need for size and status. The green-eyed monster had gotten the better of me, and I was consumed with envy. This is an oversimplification of many cross-currents, but it captures a key component of my New York vortex. Until that point, I hadn't ever experienced envy in such a visceral way, and I didn't recognize it at the time, but that's what it was. Buffett and Munger joke that envy is the only one of the seven deadly sins that isn't any fun. "Envy is crazy," remarks Munger. "It's 100% destructive. If you get those things out of your life early, life works a lot better." In my view, envy is also an emotion that we deny at our peril. In the financial markets, envy is a silent killer. It leads people to behave in ways they wouldn't if they were more honest with themselves. For example, investors see their friends make a killing off tech stocks that are crazily overvalued, and they plunge in right before the bubble bursts. It's important to be aware of these emotional forces bubbling inside us, since they fundamentally skew our judgment, messing with our ability to make rational decisions. As an ancient rabbinical saying puts it, "Who is strong? He who masters his own passions." Ben Graham wrote brilliantly about the irrationality of Mr. Market. We need to recognize that this irrationality is also an inextricable part of our all-too-human wiring. A key aspect of my education as a value investor was to learn to detect these emotional vulnerabilities in myself so I could develop strategies, as we will see later, that prevent them from subverting me. This process of self-correction begins with self-knowledge. The reason all of this matters is that investing has a way of exposing our psychological fault lines, whether it's greed, a lust for power and social status, or any other flaw. Envy was one of my biggest weaknesses at the time. I should have been happy with my lot, given that I wasn't just a member of the 1%, but the 1% of the 1%. I was in control of my time. I could live and vacation where and when I wanted. I had people to help me do the things that I didn't like to do. But the problem in a place like New York or London is that there are always so many people who are doing better than you. My office didn't have gleaming floor-to-ceiling windows or panoramic views of the Manhattan skyline. I couldn't match the elegance of Chris Hon's offices in Mayfair, London's hedge fund epicenter. My beautiful home on one of the Upper West Side's loveliest streets lacked Bill Ackman's leafy views of Central Park. I wanted to win at the hedge fund game. Rightly or wrongly, I was convinced that I was as smart as my peers, and it ate away at me that I wasn't at the very top of the heap. Doing well didn't feel like enough. I decided to market myself, but I didn't know how. On those rare occasions when I did get an audience with potential investors, I'd get nervous and revert to the behavior that had worked for me at university, blasting out a torrent of ideas at high speed in the hope that I'd sound impressive. Sometimes I'd find myself trying to dazzle people with Latin phrases like "ceteris paribus" and "sine qua non," hoping that they would see the merit of what I was saying if I spoke as if I were in a tutorial at Oxford. But the truth is that I shouldn't have bothered with this mindless pursuit of growth, which was primarily motivated by my own ego. The fund was doing well, and so much of my family's money was invested in it that I didn't need to waste time attracting additional assets from outside investors. My envy led me astray because I wanted people to see that I was managing hundreds of millions, even billions, just like Bill and Chris. That time would have been better spent focusing on picking the best stocks and allowing my performance to speak for itself. I got sucked into the New York vortex in other equally ridiculous ways. I rented a plush office in Carnegie Hall Tower and in one fell swoop drove up my annual rental expense from $60,000 to $250,000. I rented a Bloomberg terminal, the informational equivalent of smoking crack cocaine, for about $20,000 a year. I also hired a chief operating officer, an analyst, and a high-powered lawyer. It turns out that envy and pride are expensive flaws. But it wasn't just a matter of winning other people's approval. It also made me feel better about myself to have the trappings of success. I needed to know that I was on top, so I kept chasing after these false idols. My father wisely asked me, "Why are you doing all this? Why are you trying to be a hedge fund megastar?" Fortunately, I got plenty of other stuff right. Among other things, I didn't play roulette with my shareholders' money, having internalized Buffett's teaching that the first rule of investing is don't lose money, and the second rule is don't forget rule number one. I was relatively risk-averse in a way that served the fund well, particularly during the tech crash, but I think it's more helpful to share my mistakes with you than to dwell excessively on what I got right. As Munger puts it, I like people admitting that they were complete stupid horses' asses. I know I'll perform better if I rub my nose in my mistakes. This is a wonderful trick to learn. There are plenty of things I regret about that period in New York, but I made one decision that would prove hugely beneficial. I began to surround myself with a mastermind group of investors who had become lifelong friends and trusted sounding boards. It's difficult, if not impossible, to become successful on your own. The greatest opera stars have singing teachers, Roger Federer has a coach, and Buffett meets regularly with like-minded people. Our forum, which we dubbed the Posse, met once a week to discuss stocks. It included investors like David Eigen, Ken Shubenstein, Stefan Rosen, Glenn Tung, and occasionally Bill Ackman. Through it, I also met Joel Greenblatt and became a member of the Value Investors Club. The Posse met one morning a week, and at least one of us had to come prepared with a stock idea, which the rest of us would debate and dissect. This expanded my knowledge beyond anything I could have learned from a textbook or MBA course. We not only learned more about investing, but gained a deeper understanding of each other, about what made us tick or not tick. The Posse's meetings produced friendships that are a reward in their own right. From a purely investing perspective, these allies have also become a source of competitive strength, because we look out for each other. If I call members of that group and run an idea by them, it's not just what they say that's important. My knowledge of them also allows me to evaluate the information they give me. It's critical that we understand one another's biases and filters. On one memorable occasion, this group saved me from myself and reinforced for me the benefit of being open to other perspectives. I had discovered what I thought was a fantastic company. It was called Farmer Mac. One way that I look for investments is to study the masters and then explore whether I should buy the same stock or a better one with similar characteristics. Buffett had a huge investment in Freddie Mac and a substantial stake in Fannie Mae. Both companies would subsequently lose their way. But at that time, Freddie and Fannie were great businesses. Their key asset was the implied faith, backing, and credit of the US government, which meant they could borrow at virtually risk-free rates. I looked for a firm with a similar advantage and found Farmer Mac, a tiny government-sponsored enterprise in the U.S. farm sector. It struck me as an undiscovered gem of the same ilk. In 2003, I invited the company's management to give a presentation to the Posse. Whitney Tilson, who is a well-known hedge fund manager, author, and TV commentator, later shared the idea with Bill Ackman. Bill, who started an investment firm called Gotham Partners after graduating from Harvard, is a brilliant analyst with an extraordinary gift for seeing what other investors miss. A few weeks later, Bill took me aside after a breakfast meeting with the Posse and said, "Guy, there's something I want to talk to you about." Knowing his generosity and his relish for acting as a matchmaker with his single friends, I was convinced that he wanted to set me up on a date. In fact, he wanted to tell me more about Farmer Mac, having heard that I owned the stock. Apparently, Bill had stayed up until about 4 a.m., researching the company after Whitney mentioned my interest in it. The next morning, he phoned Whitney and thanked him for the most incredible opportunity I've ever seen. But it turned out that Bill wasn't buying the stock. He was shorting it. In other words, he was convinced that Farmer Mac was going to implode. As we walked about 20 blocks to his midtown office, Bill explained what he thought I was missing and why he'd established a massive short position. He thought the stock was not just going to implode, but fall to zero. He proceeded to tell me why Farmer Mac was nothing like Freddie and Fannie. I felt my stomach turn. Seeing that I didn't yet fully understand, he invited me up to his office. There, to my amazement, he showed me a shelf filled with more than a decade's worth of printed filings for Farmer Mac. These were covered with annotations and sticky notes. He had also printed out the filings for many of the company's securitizations. At first glance, they seemed just like Freddie and Fannie's securitizations, but as Bill explained, they were actually very different. In Freddie and Fannie's case, one securitization typically contained hundreds, if not thousands, of similar single-family homes. In Farmer Mac's case, the securitizations often contained only a handful of farm loans, each with very different characteristics. Bill's view was that this was not an asset that could be securitized, and that this was really more like regular business lending. As he saw it, these packages of loans were far riskier than they seemed, and the company could easily go bankrupt. At one point, I said to him, "But this is a government-sponsored enterprise. It's almost like an arm of the US government." Bill replied, "Guy, you have far too much trust in the institutions of our country." As lunchtime approached, I found myself torn between a desire to stay with him and learn more and a compulsion to rush back to my office and sell the stock. By now, it was absolutely clear to me that I didn't understand nearly enough about Farmer Mac to justify owning it. This was an important revelation. So often, we focus our analytical efforts in the wrong direction and miss something vital. So it's crucial to be open to the possibility that we might be mistaken. During our charity lunch, Buffett looked at me in all seriousness and said of his investment analysis, "I'm never wrong." In his case, this might be true, or almost true. But as the hedge fund manager Lisa Rapuano once said, "I'm not Warren Buffett, and neither are you." That day, I sold 2/3 of my holding. The next day, I dumped the rest. Luckily, I was able to sell out at a profit. I subsequently arranged a meeting with Farmer Mac's CEO and CFO. On a rainy autumn afternoon, I met Bill and Whitney at Penn Station, and we took the Acela train to the company's headquarters in Washington, D.C. The management team was ready with a standard investor presentation which emphasized the superficial similarities between Farmer Mac, Freddie, and Fannie. After one or two slides, Bill put up his hand and said, "Please, we don't need to go through your presentation. I just have a few questions." He then made the same points he had previously made to me. The management was either unable or unwilling to respond to Bill's probing questions, and they were clearly offended. At one point, the CEO said, "This might not be the company for you." I was shocked to see that he couldn't come up with a more compelling response. A week later, I shorted the stock. This was one of only three occasions in my life when I've gone short. Temperamentally, this practice doesn't suit my nature, but to my mind, the management's reaction confirmed that Bill was right. Afterward, he told me that they had even excluded him from the company's quarterly conference calls. I started to get carried away with the whole combat sport of shorting a stock. I got on these conference calls myself and asked pointed questions designed to highlight the company's weaknesses. I was determined to show other investors the risks that lurked behind the veneer. I also spoke to the New York Times, explaining these concerns. These were valid and important points, and investors had a right to know that the company was riskier than they thought, but there was a righteous or self-righteous indignation in my attitude that didn't reflect well on me. In retrospect, I feel as if I lost my way and acted like a petty tyrant. My goal as an investor is to compound money for my shareholders, not to pick unnecessary fights or conduct myself like an avenging moral crusader. I'm not criticizing other fund managers who want to do this, but it's not my role in life, and I think it distracted my mind and muddied my hands. Not long afterward, I got my comeuppance. The Wall Street Journal published an article suggesting that various hedge fund managers might be banding together to manipulate the price of stocks they were shorting. These included MBIA, Allied Capital, and Farmer Mac. Elliot Spitzer, who was then New York State's Attorney General, launched an investigation, as did the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. They wanted to know if any of the fund managers mentioned in the article had been involved in spreading misinformation about these companies. I got roped into the investigation along with Bill and the renowned hedge fund manager David Einhorn. The investigation went nowhere, but it was a stressful and expensive distraction, since I had to dig up lots of information in response to the investigators' research requests. During the financial crisis, all three stocks imploded, vindicating Bill's analysis. Farmer Mac proved to be a highly profitable short for him and me. Still, I wish I had just sold the stock and walked away, regardless of the profits that came from betting against it. As I see it, life is too short for this sort of conflict, and these investment gains didn't justify the headache. Odd as it might sound, I also think we often bring bad things on ourselves when we point the finger at others or act in a tyrannical way. In my experience, it's karmically better to focus on the positive and act as a force for good instead of getting gratuitously embroiled in acrimonious battles. I wonder if Elliot Spitzer, who was himself later disgraced, discovered this same truth after years of crusading to take other people down. I yearned to find a path that was simpler and better for my mental health. In New York, I had drifted off course, allowing myself to get caught up in a series of unnecessary distractions. But I was starting to realize that I didn't need a fancy office. I didn't need to attract more assets to my fund as a way of proving to others and myself that I was a big shot, and I didn't need the angst and acrimony that came with shorting stocks. In other words, I had learned enough by now to sense what didn't work for me, but I still need